Evidence Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprint, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Evident Footprints here on BBSRadio.com. So nice to be with you tonight. It is the 8th of March, 2008, on the East Coast, the 7th of March, on the West Coast. And this is both my favorite time of the week and also my not-so-favorite time of the week, and the reason for that, that latter statement, is because I won't see you over the weekend. And we have been into a sort of a stream of consciousness type of show format for the past 3 weeks. And been getting a lot of email, a lot of phone calls, and positive response from folks that have really enjoyed all the guests that we have had on the show. And we're going to continue to bring quality guests, authors, scientists, inventors, metaphysicians, musicians, artists, people that have a message that the world needs to hear. And of course, we're bringing about solutions, and we will continue to do that. And we want to encourage you tonight, especially, because we have nothing really to talk about. No, I'm just kidding. We want to invite you to call in. Maybe you have some questions or comments for our regular guest, Jim Murray. Now, before I bring him on, I want to give you the phone numbers. We're going to be using the numbers at BBS Station 1. And please call in. We want you to participate in this show as well. The number toll-free in the USA only is area code 877-876-5227. In the USA and Canada, the toll-free number is area code 888-815-9756. And the direct line, regardless of wherever you are, if you want to pay for the call, it's area code 530-876-3222. And with that, I want to bring on board my regular guest. He's a scientist, an inventor extraordinaire, an author. He wrote a book called Tunnels, which we spoke about on some past shows, and we may take up in another conversation. When the book comes out, you will find it on my website, directlightproductions.com, under the books section. In fact, all the authors that we have on the show have been gracious enough to allow us to post the information, so it makes it easier for you to get your hands and eyes on the book that they've written, or books in some cases. We've had a lot of people ask about the creature from Jekyll Island. We had a couple of weeks ago, we had G. Edward Griffin on the show. And also the book Wrongly Blamed by Dr. Qasem Khalil. That book has gotten a lot of publicity lately. He has written another book about the origin of science, and that's also on my website. And we've got Judy Andreas's books. We're getting quite a collection, as well as Zenith Stars and Foreseen Beyond Time by Michael St. Clair. Good collection of books, a lot of very valuable information. And I mentioned Tunnels, and we're going to bring the author of that book on right now. He's usually my regular Friday night guest, and his name is Jim Murray. Jim, how are you tonight?
I'm great, Don. How are you?
I'm good.
That's great. I appreciate the plug for the book. There's one thing that I think I should clarify. All of our discussions pretty much have been on a fairly elevated scientific and philosophical level. And I think it's important for me to clarify the fact that Tunnels is a story about some of the antics that I was involved in when I was in the sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything but scientific,
yes.
As you probably know. But I think it's a very interesting adventure story, and it's a coming-of-age story, which some of the readers might enjoy. And if you have a soft spot in your heart for a tough, if you have a soft spot in your heart for a tough kid from Jersey City, then you might enjoy it.
Sure. Well, I mentioned the book because you did write it, and that officially makes you an author as well.
That's true. And I am writing a second book, as you know, and I think that'll be more in keeping with the image that I'm trying to form of myself.
Okay. Jim, pardon me for one second. I'm going to see if I can get Seth to boost your volume just a little bit in my headphone feed, and thank him in advance for doing that. Your voice has disappeared a little bit from the level it was when we were setting it. So.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Oh, I can hear you. I would just like to hear you a little bit clearer, let's say. Seth, if you're there, if you can turn Jim up a little bit for me, I would appreciate it. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, that sound like assuming, an advertisement. Can you hear me?
Assuming that will be done, we've been talking about a lot of interesting things. We've been talking about the grays and the reptilians and a little bit about the planetary anomalies that are now appearing in photographs. I have been getting ready to post a humongous amount of stuff on the planets and some moons. And some of these pictures you have already seen, some we talked about last week. I'm going to be putting all of those up on my site. For the audience's information, this is for the listening audience, of course. I have also been posting many of the interviews that we have been doing so that people can find out a little bit more about what these archives are about, so that if they're looking for a particular topic, they know they can go to BBS Radio and sign up for 25. I think it's $24.95, say roughly $25 for the whole year. You can download all the archives, and that's really an incredible value. And as well as on my site, you can listen and read about what these archives are about. So there's some extra information there. And Jim, you have more archives than anybody else, and when I'm caught up, definitely that will be the case because you're on every week. There's a wealth of scientific information. So when someone is listening to the archive, they could be on BBS listening to the archive and going to my site and actually seeing some of the things that you and I are talking about. So we're trying to make this become an interactive type of multimedia. That's the concept. And it does take a lot of planning, as you well know. You do a lot of lab work, and you know that you want to publish your results, but you have to follow certain protocol and procedures to make that come to pass. And it's the same thing in setting up a website and making this information available. So we ask the audience to bear in mind that we would like to be able to show these pictures while we're talking about them and talking about planets and all that, and so I have to do a little bit of work to make that possible, that we have some visual representations while we're talking about this stuff. I think it would make it a lot more interesting for the listeners too.
Okay, I can grasp that. There are some photographs and diagrams and things which I may be able to send you for posting, which but also lend some support to that idea. I'll talk to you about that next week if you want.
Okay. Yeah, that would be great. Now, I don't know if you had any more time to look at those Mars photographs that we were talking about. What I've heard from a variety of sources is that's stirring up quite a controversy now, the fact that there is evidence of a civilization up there. And although they have not been identified in any official capacity, we know that there has to be, to an extent, some other sort of technology being used, and that the technologies that even made that possible are being withheld from us here on Earth. I mean, we're caught up in this oil paradigm, if you want to call it that. Everything is based around the petroleum industry, and the technologies that we're given are just meted out as they decide it's time to make money with a new little toy or a new little invention. And they're keeping the advancements in energy technologies away from the people until they figure out how they're going to charge us for it and keep that power base, that economic power base, in their own hands.
I agree with you on that. And but what is interesting about this this whole thing, I don't know if you've ever noticed this or not, but this afternoon when you and I chatted, and you were telling me that you were going to more or less let me decide what we wanted to chat about tonight. The most interesting thing that occurred to me when I was thinking about all these alien technologies and these really far out things that we've been discussing, and there's a very interesting trend in our society, which I know other people have picked up on, but I don't think we've discussed it on the air. And that is that it seems, in a very large number of cases, that when new technologies are about to burst out eventually be disclosed, whether it be through design or happenstance, it's always interesting to notice that sometime before that occurs, there seems to be something very similar introduced in a science fiction story. And so I sat down and made a list of the science fiction movies that affected me the most over the years and helped to mold my interest and whatnot when I was a kid, and of course continue to affect me to some extent. And it is very interesting now to go back and look at some of these early things, which, even though they were sources of great interest and stimulation to me as a kid, have actually come to pass in reality. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I'm bringing this up is because a lot of the stuff you and I have talked about in the minds of the average public probably comes across as science fiction. But most science fiction has its basis in something. If the author has an inspiration about a particular thing, and he writes a story on it and then publishes it, we have to remember that inspirations come from a very definite source. And it's the same source that eventually stimulates the minds of scientists and technicians. So it's very interesting that there's a hysteresis or a delay between what's written about and what comes to pass. And mm-hmm. I thought, Don, if you're interested in this approach, that we could touch on some of these concepts, because they pretty much start to touch upon everything we've discussed, and then they project on into things that we haven't discussed, but maybe we should.
Well, I'm not interested at all, so I hope. No, I'm just kidding. No, I have to get some humor in here. Okay, we're about to get serious. So. You know, I'm just joking. I'm being crazy. But, yes, that makes a lot of sense. Before you go into anything, can I just add a caveat remark here and say that I think there's two kinds of creativity in that sense. There's the spontaneous creativity of that individual that would come out with a futuristic story, either based upon something that he deduces from cosmic consciousness, if you want to call it that, from universal consciousness. And then there's the intentional release of this information to prepare us for some sort of paradigm shift.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I didn't make any distinction between them because I think that if and when we really start to examine some of these things, it'll become pretty obvious which are which.
Yes, yes. Well, that's just for the audience that I did that. So, and for myself, I guess. Well, have at it.
All right. Well, I think that I'm going to start with the story that literally changed my life as a kid, and just use that as a stepping off point for some of these others, because it's going to be obvious to everyone who recognizes the title of this movie that obviously the content of the story has come to pass in our world, and mm-hmm. that would be 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Now,
okay.
I saw that. I think I was 7 years old in the State Theater in Jersey City, and I came out of that place mesmerized. And of course, we all know the story, so there's no point in going into it. But the character of Captain Nemo and his genius. And the idea that he could create this vessel with such incredible destructive power and such an unbelievable source of energy, long before, the people of his time could even conceive of such a thing, is probably one of the most dynamic aspects of the whole story. But the interesting thing about it is, and of course I didn't know this when I was seven, but I found out afterwards, The concept of a submarine is, even though it was put forth in this story by Jules Verne in the 1860s, the actual concept, the first, one of the first written histories of it goes far back as Leonardo da Vinci, as far as a powered craft is concerned, and it goes back to the time of Alexander the Great as far as a submersible is concerned. So it's very interesting that this kind of stuff has been in the human psyche for a very long time. And one of the things that's really intriguing is that the original Nautilus was not an atomic vessel, but an electric vessel, an all-electric submarine. And I've always found that to be really interesting. So I thought I'd lead off with that only because it certainly is well known that here is an idea which was floating around in human consciousness for a very, very long time, was eventually made into an incredible novel by Jules Verne, and then became a reality in our time. And this seems to be exactly what happened. Things slowly seep from the etheric into the physical world. And these concepts are brought forward by various people that are sensitive to these inspirations and who have the wherewithal and the means to make them happen. And I think that's a fascinating thing.
Do you think by any chance, Jim, that that consciousness came from another civilization, let's say from Lemuria or Atlantis, that maybe they had these craft back in those days?
Well, my personal belief is that there's very little new under the sun. And if you believe in an Atlantis, as I do, and some of the other earlier centers of civilization, there's no reason for them not to have had this stuff if they were as advanced as they are claimed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that could be the source of inspiration because it could be handed down literally in documents or stories. But also, I think that that some of these concepts get swept into the Akashic record or into the general consciousness, and they're just kind of floating around up there with all the rest of the stuff in a huge soup, a celestial soup of ideas. And in that broth is any kind of inspiration you would ever want. But when someone tunes into an appropriate line of thought that attracts one of those ideas, then all of a sudden he has an inspiration. I mean, it's something like that. because you can shift your point of interest, and there'll already be an inspiration waiting for you. Like, for instance, my inspirations have always been about physics and mechanics and science and electricity, but talking to you, I realized that I also have more latent interests, for instance, in music and the structure of sound and these types of things. And I know full well that if I concentrated on that stuff and really got into it, I would start to receive inspirations on that channel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way things seem to work.
Sure. Well, it makes you also contemplate that if we focused our attention on going into the Akashic record and bringing thoughts about peace from there, that we could possibly create perpetual peace on this planet, which would be a totally new idea. You know, it's been talked about. People talk about it every day, but it's not the intention of those that control this matrix, to lead us down that path.
No, but there are organizations, though, that do try to do exactly that.
Sure,
You know that as well as I do.
Sure.
But, you know, they're up against stiff odds because of the fact that the evil ones who run this place seem to really have a very intense hold on the most facets of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, they really got, they're dug in like an Alabama tick.
Yeah. Well, you know, what do you, you know, going back to Jules Verne, what do you think his message was in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea?
You know, that's a tough one, because there's a huge dichotomy between what was actually written about in the story versus what the undercurrents were in the movie. But I think if you want that question answered, we have to kind of examine the personality of Captain Nemo. And basically, this was a guy who, if you, and believe it or not, I was so taken up with this that I did a lot of research on Captain Nemo, and it turns out that Jules Verne actually modeled his original story after an individual who really existed. Now, whether he built the submarine or not, I don't know, but he came from an extraordinarily wealthy family, and he was versed in the sciences, and he was versed in finances and banking and a whole bunch of other stuff. He was really quite a genius. And he was so disgusted with the way in which knowledge was put to use on the planet by the majority of people who were in the position to use it as leverage against their fellow man, that he decided to, extricate himself from, the normal ways of living and spend his, time in a different environment. So he chose the ocean. But unfortunately, there's always a string somewhere. They wouldn't let the guy do this. When they discovered that he had found this new source of power, you know, they wanted it for themselves. They tortured and killed his wife and child, and they did all these things. So even though he accomplished his basic mission to extricate himself from the rest of the world and become a source of law unto himself, He went away a very scarred individual and decided to take vengeance on the people who had mistreated him. So I don't know exactly what the message is, but it almost seems, if you boil it down to its barest essence, that it's trying to tell you that there is always some real big sacrifice and a lot of karma or a lot of discomfort associated with the birth of new knowledge and new technology. It's almost like it doesn't happen for free or it doesn't happen easily. And actually, I've seen that concept repeated in many instances, as you well know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was having thoughts about that very statement that you made just now, earlier today, in the context of how they just relentlessly push this agenda on us as if there's nothing other than what they say. You know, I'm referring specifically, and I don't mean to go off on a tangent other than to just substantiate what you said. I was listening to 5 minutes of the Lou Dobbs show tonight, and they were going to play, an audio bite of, former Mexican president Vicente Fox slamming Lou Dobbs about, his take on what's happening to our border situation. And the overwhelming thought came to me that here is one man on a whole network that's bent on putting out propaganda, and really he's being very constrained as to what he can talk about. Why is it, other than just because these people are just relentless about controlling everything, why is it that only one person on that whole network approaches this? Is this intentional on their part to just allow him that little bit of slack in the leash to expand upon what's really going on? But still we have this matrix, you know, regardless of what he brings to light and anyone's perception about what's really going on, they're just bent on keeping the truth from coming out. Now, it's the same thing when we're talking about advancements in science or in technology, that they hold these things back from us. They don't dare let us know that they exist, because that would lead to a higher consciousness. That would lead to us freeing ourselves from this. So that I think the undercurrent theme, regardless of whether it's politics or science or medicine or what have you, religion, if the truth is going to weaken their stranglehold on mankind, they don't want it to come out. And so.
Well, I agree with you on that for sure.
Yes.
I think that, the thing that really makes it interesting and also demonstrates some glimmer of hope, you know, for the rest of us, for the rest of the world, is the fact that there are usually individuals that have a lot of chutzpah, and whatever their particular gift is, they do their best to get it out there, irregardless of the undercurrents and the discouragement and the brainwashing and everything else. And if it weren't for people like that, we wouldn't be having this conversation on the airwaves. We'd be sitting across from each other in a damp cave, passing a bone back and forth while we talk about these things. And, you know, that's literally the way it would be. Because without the constant flow of new ideas from the Godhead into the general consciousness, and then eventually into a particular consciousness that has the fortitude to bring it out in some way, shape, or form, we just wouldn't progress at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Thing. Yeah. Go ahead, Jim.
All right, well, the next show that just blew me away when I was a kid was the story of Mary Shelley's story of Frankenstein. Now, I actually saw the movie before I read the book, but I have to tell you that I was so affected by that film, the entire concept of this relationship between high voltage and ethereal powers, and the concept of life, and this half-baked scientist who was interested in capitalizing on that in a very distorted manner, but nonetheless looking to prove that relationship to himself by trying to animate corpses, really made a very striking effect on me as a kid. Now, I wasn't interested in animating corpses, but I was very excited about the possibility that there was a link between electricity and life. And because of the fact that I had such an interest in high voltage and, you know, the physics of electricity, it was a natural magnet for me. But what was really interesting about it, and this I didn't discover until either high school or early college, I don't remember anymore exactly when I found it out, but Mary Shelley based her story of Frankenstein on an actual guy that was tinkering with these very things in Germany, and who, I don't know if his name was Frankenstein or not, but he had a castle, he had a lot of money, and he was into an investigation of etheric forces and alchemy and, you know, the essence of life and all these things. And her basic message was very interesting, and that is that there are some things which man is probably not supposed to tinker with, and if we insist on doing it, then it brings about very negative repercussions. Well, I'm interested in the parallels that are happening right now between the Frankenstein story and the negative outcome of such investigations. I mean, we know, for instance, that in secret laboratories in a lot of places, people are actually playing with clones. They're playing with chimerons, which is, I think the way it's pronounced, is a mix between two different species. They're playing around with splicing the genes of men and animals. They're doing all these things, which obviously God never intended for anybody to do. And interestingly enough, if you go back into history and you examine the mythologies that we are taught as kids, there's little grains of truth in there that this has actually happened before. And if you read, Casey's version of Atlantis, for instance, and some of the writings of the ancient priests of Egypt and whatnot, they talk about the fact that these exact types of things were messed with in Atlantean times and resulted in great havoc and also great detriment to the souls of the people who were involved in these types of experiments.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you splice a goat and a man, for instance, it's all very well and good to say, oh, look, we got a critter running around here that's half man and half goat. But if that thing dies, are the souls intertwined? Do you have a problem, with what happens after death? I mean, these are things that most people don't even bother to think about. And yet, in Egypt, there were entire temples dedicated to removing or extricating human spirits from the animal components that had been, that they had been meshed with in Atlantean times.
Mm-hmm.
And there's quite a bit of writing on that subject, so it's probably not 100% myth. It's got to be based on something.
Yeah,
but I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just saying I agree with you, and I was going to bring up something that I heard very recently, that they're combining, they're splicing genes between a tomato and I think cattle. I mean, they have nothing to do with their time that they come up with these sadistic ideas.
Genes between what? Tomatoes?
Tomato and cattle.
Cattle?
Cattle, yes. I mean, you have some sadistic experiments going on here. Now, whether they're going to be successful with that or not, I don't know, but the thought entered my mind too while you were talking about mythology, is that they're portraying all of this stuff that possibly comes to the forefront of mankind's consciousness as mythology because they don't want us to see the truth behind it. Wouldn't it be interesting if our future mythology, when we create a new reality, will be politics? I think that will be very interesting. Now, you have the ball again on your side of the court, Jim.
I'm going to deliberately not say what's on my mind concerning that subject because it'll be too vile for radio.
Are you talking about a new fertilizer that's invented?
let me just move ahead here.
I'll try not to be psychic.
That's okay. Actually, before we leave the subject of Frankenstein, I would like to mention, though, that there was a gentleman named George Lakofsky, who you probably heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent his life's work actually building these high-voltage devices and high-frequency oscillators that were called multiple wave oscillators. And although I don't think he did any experiments of to induce life, he did do an enormous amount of work in using this equipment to cure cancer. And he had a lot of cures of cancer and other diseases that are actually attributed to his methodologies. And of course, very, very little of that has come down to us. Most of it has been suppressed or lost in time. But he wasn't that long ago. I believe he was in the early 1900s, 1910, 1915, somewhere around in there.
Mm-hmm.
And just another example of how things are not allowed to benefit the human race. The next story that I thought was really, really interesting and basically affected me a lot as a kid was a Boris Karloff movie. Of course, Frankenstein was a Boris Karloff movie too, but this was completely different in character because it wasn't about monsters or anything of that sort. It was about a scientist who had developed a method of attaching an electronic device to his telescope and reattracting light waves that left the Earth eons ago, and actually being able to view on a screen the developmental history of the planet. And one of the things that he sees in these optical time travels, as it were, is the fact that this huge meteor made out of some very luminous and unknown substance crashes to Earth somewhere in Africa. And he makes it his goal to go and discover what this is because he feels that it's the representative of a new element. And make a long story short, what happens is that truly enough, this turns out to be some very, very powerful radioactive material, which of course has come from outer space. And he uses this and concentrates it in a kind of a cannon-like thing to produce an invisible ray. And, of course, unfortunately, he winds up being poisoned by the radioactivity. He loses his marbles, and he does some rather nasty things with this ray. But the thing that I thought was pretty amazing, especially in later years when I studied a lot about Egypt, is the fact that there have been down through history, a lot of important things attached, or a lot of important concepts attached to objects that reach the Earth from space. Now, in Egypt, the pyramidon, the little topmost part of the pyramid, like the last pyramidal-shaped brick that they would put on the top of the pyramid, was always made of a dark-colored stone that had some kind of hieroglyphs on it, and it was in memory of a thing called the Benben, and the Benben was supposed to have been a very magical stone having incredibly unusual properties. They don't go into a great amount of detail, unfortunately, telling you what these properties may have been. But what's really interesting is that this stone apparently fell from heaven, and it must have been large enough that everybody saw it come down, and there was enough left over that they made the first pyramid top piece out of one of these things. Now, what significance that has in the general scheme of things, I'm not sure, but it just goes to show you that here again is an interesting parallel between a stone that fell from space in a sci-fi movie, which was endowed with unusual powers and whatnot, and a real stone that fell from space, which is actually in the record, and which was somehow an inspiration to these people to make, to use that for capping their pyramids, which I think is a very interesting concept. And of course, the invisible ray thing in modern times is very similar to the concept of ray weapons or particle beam weapons and that type of thing. So here again, we see that there's multiple tiers of consciousness in this, again, winding up in something that literally occupies a space in our present reality.
Yes. Now, my recollection of the Ben Ben was that it was a sacred stone from the Heliopolis Temple, and I think they said that it was located in Anu, which would have been would that be a connection to the Anunnaki?
Possibly. I don't know enough about it to really give you an authoritative answer. But I know that the original Ben Ben, like you say, was kept in a very secure place, but it served as a model for these other stones that they built to cap various monuments. And there has to be a reason behind that. I mean, it seems to me that maybe this stone had some kind of properties to it that would give them the inspiration to stick replicas of it on top of various buildings. I mean, I can't figure out what it's for, but maybe you have some insights into that, Don.
Well, the capstone itself, at being the shape of a pyramid, takes on the metaphysical characteristics of a pyramid itself, in that it's a smaller pyramid. It, as long as it is conforming to the, let's say, the proportions that a pyramid has. For instance, a true pyramid is not made up of equilateral triangles.
Right.
And because of that, you have certain sacred numbers that form the apex, and you can calculate the circumference. These are repeating, unending numbers, these sacred numbers. And that there is a power that is of a metaphysical nature, in that the numbers don't end, so therefore, really, the structure itself doesn't end. It may end in terms of our visual, three-dimensional sight, eyesight, but if it's an unending number, then does the structure really end in its totality? And so it would probably cause it to be multi-dimensional in that sense, beyond three dimensions, but reaching out even beyond time into the etheric. Those are the things about the universe that are mysteries to man, because we're more focused on debunking those types of things, which lead us to a higher consciousness. I do know quite a bit about the phenomenon of pyramids, they are recognized. They were chosen to be what they are based on what a pyramid can do with energy.
Yeah. So I agree with that.
So it only makes sense that if it's to remain a four-sided, actually five sides if you count the base, a five-sided, five-pointed object. It's the only tetrahedron that has five points and five sides. And with those proportions, if it's going to have that, it has to have a pyramid at the top.
Yeah.
So that capstone is what allowed them to continue that shape. But its ultimate measurement would have to be of a certain proportion to allow those sacred numbers to be the measurements that make it work. And it was seen from outer space as well. They were intentionally made to be beacons, if you want to call them that, that could be seen from space, from deep space.
Yeah, so, well, I believe that. As a matter of fact, we talked just a week or two ago about the interesting fact that the Arabic word for Cairo translates directly as Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the fact that there's also pyramids on Mars, it just seems to me that that's anything but a coincidence. But what do I know?
Yep. Well, these, you know, the photos that we're talking about from Mars definitely show that there's a lot more going up there than just those artifacts. And that's something new that the new listeners that didn't hear our previous shows about this. Actually, we covered this last Monday, or a week ago Monday, as well as Friday, the prior Friday.
Yes, we did.
And for anyone that wants to go into the archives and look at that, I think it was February 22nd and February 25th when we talked about those anomalies on Mars. And, you know, my sneaking suspicion is that we would be finding similar anomalies, if you want to call them that, on other planets as well. That it's not something that's been left just to the Earth and to Mars.
Well, I have a tendency to agree with you because I feel that there has been a pretty intelligent race of some sort that came through this whole solar system eons ago and explored and mapped everything and left, you might say, their calling card in the form of some of these huge monuments. And the fact that you would find, let's say, pyramids on Mars and pyramids on maybe the moons of Jupiter or, you know, some other places like that besides Earth would certainly indicate that there's a very methodical and long-term program in place by somebody who decided to come through here and study our solar system. And the mere fact that there would be ancient remnants of that sort, let's say on a variety of planets, or maybe even on all of them, certainly lends support to the fact that somebody was not only here with great intelligence and capability, but that their presence was in this vicinity for quite some time before they moved on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a fascinating concept, and it's just a darn shame that the rulers of our planet at present are such narrow-minded, reptilian-brained people, because if they are aware of this type of stuff, even though it's against their better judgment, you know, from their perspective, it would literally change everything that that we know about ourselves and our concept of the universe if this information was not only released but actually endorsed by the proper authorities.
Mm-hmm.
It's really amazing that evil can hold so much power, isn't it, Don?
Yeah. Well, you know, since you brought up the pyramids, it's worth pointing out that for the past several hundred years, those that have studied the pyramids have really embarked upon an in-depth study of the structure itself, and they've recorded the anomalies that have occurred. For instance, the animals that get lost inside the pyramid and die because of they can't find their way out, and they suffer from dehydration or starvation, maybe even die from fear, just you know, the panic of not being able to get out. They don't deteriorate, they don't decay, and that they can literally collect snakes and rats and mice and whatever critters wander into the structure and just throw them in a trash can, and they don't decay. And so there is an energy there. Now, is that mummification? Well, that's a process of mummification, that it ceases the destruction of the corpse of those animals. But what is really happening there is the energy in the pyramid is not allowing bacterial growth. And so there is a phenomenon going on there that is of a scientific or a metaphysical nature. It's a very high science, in fact, and that the pyramids were not built to be tombs. That's something that the pharaohs themselves decided they were going to make use of. But there's no value in the pyramid being used as a tomb, other than that maybe they thought that that might give them some eternal life, because they knew what the phenomenon was regarding those living creatures that did not decay. And that mummification would be more of a ceremony than an actual necessity to preserve the body. It was the pyramid itself that was doing that.
Yeah, I agree with that. At least in part. I don't think they've ever found an actual corpse in a pyramid, which is interesting. But I am aware of the fact that it has the ability to discourage any form of decay. As a matter of fact, my early investigations into pyramids, I built small models of the pyramids, maybe, 2 feet high, you know, that type of thing. And in the position of the king's chamber, we used to put little cubes of steak. And the ones that were left on the outside in a closed container would putrefy in a very short period of time. And the pieces of meat that were left under the pyramid would literally dehydrate and just become this leather-like substance with no smell, no obvious signs of decay, no bacteria of any kind. Very, very interesting.
Yeah,
so I'm aware of that.
Yeah, I've conducted those experiments too, along the lines of what Patrick Flanagan was doing. And I could put things outside. I could put a pyramid outside, take a plate of meat, for instance, ground beef, and put a control sample outside, and within a short period of time, the sample outside the pyramid would be infested with maggots. And I could literally take that sample and put it in the pyramid, remove the one that had no maggots on it, and cause what happened after a matter of 15, 20 minutes, the maggots would flee. They would literally crawl off the plate and try to get out of the pyramid. It was quite an interesting experiment. And then, of course, I did the sharpening of razor blades and modifying different food substances. You could put a piece of chocolate candy in there and actually make it taste sweeter.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting phenomenon. Now, what is really going on there is it's got to have some effect because of the electromagnetic properties of the structure in modifying the molecular makeup of whatever you put in there. Seems to be a pronouncement of certain qualities. That's the best term I could use, because it sharpens a razor blade, but it makes a food substance sweeter, for example, or less likely to decay, as you just described.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I would love to know more about it, but as you know, there's not too much information floating around on that subject.
Well, and isn't it a bit interesting that there are people that use or they've developed pyramid structures similar to tents, let's say, that they sleep in, and people describe a heightened state of consciousness, meditating or praying or sleeping under one of these. And it's very similar, and I say similar with a bit of reservation, to the Indian teepees.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I found that cones and pyramids have very similar effects if they're made at the same angle, you know, at the same angle of the apex. As a matter of fact, my investigations into the practices in Atlanta reveal the interesting fact that the origin of the dunce cap is actually an extension of pyramid technology, because since the cone is in a sense a transformed pyramid, the interesting thing is if you had a student that was slow and you put one of these cones on his head that was tuned to his particular frequency, then it would actually accelerate the student's learning capability. But yet, over the years, when that became completely marred in its true nature, the only thing that was remaining was the idea that a cone-shaped hat belonged on a student that was stupid. So it became, the dunce cap became a symbol of a backward student rather than a mechanism for helping a student. And I found that to be very interesting. Also, I tried making both pyramid-shaped caps and cone-shaped caps and putting them on my own head just to see what I would experience, and I found that under certain conditions, the whole top of your head gets cold, which is very interesting because the vortex that's created by that is very similar to the vortex that twists the planet Earth. And as you know, the planet Earth, where the vortex tightens is the same position where the north and south poles are, and that's where the lowest temperatures on the planet are. So I found all these things rather interesting, but I don't understand them all either.
They took the dunce cap and turned it upside down and put a couple of scoops of ice cream on it and turned that into a food. So, you know. And it holds the cold ice cream for a while anyway. So.
Well, that's true. There may be something to that too. I don't know. That's a good point. Maybe we should look into that.
Practice with the ice cream, huh?
Well, why not? There's truth hidden in everything, as you know.
Yes. Yes, that's true. Well, so we sort of went off on a tangent, but, on pyramids, but that's one of the earlier forms of technology, isn't it?
Yes, and it may be a lot earlier than we think, too. Remember that.
Yes. Now, on a previous show, and actually even on some shows that you were not my guest on, I talked about this phenomenon of capturing electricity from the atmosphere using a hoop. And I'm thinking of a lab I went to a few months ago. You know where I'm speaking about, where I got to see this phenomenon in action, where there was a light bulb attached to this hoop, and it was producing electricity. Do you care to talk about that concept at all? Because this is something I think people would find interesting in our closing minutes here.
Well, I don't mind talking about it, except for the fact that we sort of gave our word that we wouldn't talk about that particular technology. But in general, I think that it's fair to say that the Earth itself is bathed in an enormous amount of cosmic energy, which manifests itself in a number of ways on the planet, and that's a God-given mechanism that's part of the structure we live on. So if we imitate some of those things in miniature, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to take power out of the atmosphere or out of the cosmos surrounding the planet, however you want to interpret it. It's just a question of having the insight to figure out how to do that and the knowledge of physics to support the reduction of that higher type of energy into a form that is usable for us. And I think that there have been lots of people who have discovered this. We already talked about all kinds of people that were messing with this type of stuff. My favorite, of course, being Nikola Tesla, but there were others.
Yeah.
And you know, the fact that there are others is very encouraging, Don, because it means that as gifted as Tesla was, and I'm sure he was a true genius in the absolute sense of the term, he was not the only one. You know, you had all kinds of people that received this type of information, and for all I know, there are people still receiving it. So it goes to show you that there is an intention on the part of the universe to share knowledge with us if we're of the right mindset and if we have the right intentions about what we do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think I'm giving away any secrets here. That's not my intention. Just to talk about that phenomenon that shapes and of course, you know, I suppose you could probably do this with a cone too, couldn't you? If it's of the right proportion, or I mean, there are probably simple solutions staring us right in the face that regardless of, you know, how much money the Rockefellers want to make or General Electric, in billing people for the production of electricity, we're going to come up with other methods. People are going to be inspired to, create and invent new devices that are readily going to be able, to be used by regular people.
Well, on that note, I'll tell you something that I personally have done, and, I don't care who repeats the experiment. I know it'll work if it's done properly. I read somewhere that the original coating that was on the Great Pyramid, of course, was a smooth limestone finish, and that it had been hand-polished and rubbed down with some sort of paint that was impregnated with gold dust. And as a result of that, when the pyramid was a finished structure, it could be seen shining brilliantly in the sunlight for thousands of miles. Probably this is one of the reasons that it was visible from space, as you pointed out earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But also, gold is an exceptional conductor of electricity, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
And so having that inspiration, I glued some aluminum foil on the four surfaces of the pyramid that I had been using to investigate the pyramidal forces. And I connected the opposite segments together, like the plates of a capacitor,
mm-hmm.
and aligned it true north and south. And when I first made a measurement across the plate, I didn't get any voltage whatsoever. But I let it sit for a whole day, and the next morning, there was considerable voltage there, enough to definitely read on a multimeter, and it was not a digital meter in those days either. It was an analog meter, which means that there was a fair amount of current available to flex the needle.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but for the size of the capacitance that would be associated with plates that small, the device exhibited a very interesting characteristic, and that is that even though the needle did run down after you kept the meter attached to it for any length of time, if you broke the connection and waited only a few seconds and returned the meter to, you know, contact with the plate, the potential was there again, which is very, very interesting, because seems to indicate that there is a mechanism here which is accruing charge from someplace and doing it at no cost to us.
That's an accumulator, yeah.
Yeah, and by the way, I was going to get into that in the next segment, but the whole concept of the accumulator and its relationship to these types of forces was well investigated by Wilhelm Reich, as you well know.
Yes.
And he used it for curing cancer and other diseases, and of course they killed him for it. So, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. These ideas have been floating around, and are still available to us to do things with. The thing of it is, we have to have the proper mindset or the inspiration won't come to us. And I'm very disappointed with the fact that an awful lot of people, once you start to tell them anything that's outside the mainstream, they will immediately poo-hoo it and say that, well, that's a lot of rubbish. If there was anything to that, we'd already have it. And of course, those are the very people who, the universe refuses to give any inspirations to. So it's a very interesting, catch-22 situation. You have to already believe that you can be inspired before you will be.
Yeah, I think it's even knowing that you're going to be inspired.
Yeah, exactly. The knowing.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting. Now we're sort of morphing into a really interesting topic, but we've run out of time. So maybe next time we can continue on this scale. And,
well, I would like to do that because I have a pretty long list here, and we could go for at least another show, possibly two.
Okay. We'll do that. We'll do that.
Great.
And I always reserve the right for you to come on if you want to do two consecutive nights. You know, we reserve Friday for you, but if you want to come on, let's say and follow up the next show, so that we maintain this continuity, that invitation's always there for you.
Well, when would the next show be? Monday?
Well, we could do one Monday, for example. I could book you for that right now, and that would save me the trouble of doing a rant.
Well, I'd be happy to do that with you. You know that.
Okay, well, we'll pick up on this.
I just don't want to bump anybody if you have somebody else already booked.
No. I, you know, sometimes the spirit just tells me, leave that date open for the moment, and then you see how quickly it filled? So... So I'll put you on the schedule for next Monday. The whole world will see that. You'll be on the show next Monday.
Well, let's do it. I enjoy the idea a lot.
Okay. And this whole concept of these devices that are really, universal devices, these are not limited to this reality. In fact, they keep it from us because they empower us. And it's important for us to talk about these things. And maybe we'll get some calls. You know, I gave the numbers out, but nobody called. Maybe they're just finding it so fascinating that, they don't want to interrupt the flow.
Yeah, and maybe.
They're on the edge of their seats waiting for my next joke, I guess. So they'll have to wait till Monday.
All right. Well, I'll be here for you, Don. I promise.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming on the show, and I look forward to next Monday and hopefully the listening audience will as well. We'll have Jim Murray on again next Monday. See how spontaneous this show is. We even invite our guests back on the show. So thanks, Jim, and thank you, folks, for listening to bbsradio.com. This has been Evident Footprints, and our guest this evening was scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, teacher, and comedian, Jim Murray, and I'm your host, Don Nikoloff. We'll be back next week, 10 p.m. Pacific time on Monday, and our guest will be, again, Jim Murray. So please have a good weekend. Peace, love, and light, and good night.
got our pork and beans, we got our coffee, and we got this real nice campfire. Now all we need is the radio. Go get that radio so we can listen to BBS.
Gosh darn, boss, got this here radio, but we ain't got no battery.
Well, I told you to buy some batteries yesterday, but you forgot to buy them today.
A man can only do so many things in one day. Go into town and get some for the both of us.
Go ahead, make my day.
Dag nabbit, you and your BBS radio.